Doesn't it feel like a job that you like make up as a child to be like, this is how I want
to
save the world as an urban planner?
To be frank, it is kind of exactly what I would want to do.
Hi everyone, and welcome to the Planorama podcast brought to you by SERPA, TMU's School of Urban and Regional Planning alumni. Today's episode is with MPL 2017 grad Kira Webster, and we're talking climate prepared and future ready cities. Happy listening and happy planning. Today we ask, what does the future hold for cities? As urban planners, we are all future-oriented. Planning ahead is what we do, and it's right there in the name. But our guest today has spent her entire career thinking decades into the future through work planning smart cities at Sidewalk Labs and at Urban Strategies, and now from her base in Copenhagen advising cities around Europe on climate change preparedness with EIT Climate Kick. It is my distinct pleasure to sit down with my good friend, former coworker, and classmate, and dare I say planning idol, it's Kira Webster from MPL 2017. Welcome, Kira.
Hey, Neil. Great to be here.
I'm so glad to have you on.
I know. Well, my pleasure.
I can't believe we flew you in from Copenhagen for this.
Yeah, me too. Me too. There's nothing I'd rather do.
So we are sitting down for those who can't see us. Which is everyone, because it's a podcast. We're at the Urban Strategies office today, where I work and where you had your first planning job out of school. But we are really lucky to be able to do this. You're in town for a few days from Copenhagen, where you now live. Tell me what brought you to Copenhagen.
Ooh, that's a big, long answer, I guess. So I went to Copenhagen a while back, actually when I was in grad school, doing the Master's of Planning. And we had been, and we'll probably talk about this later as well, but we had been in the Netherlands for a field trip related to studio, and we had time to, you know, travel afterwards. I think it was coinciding with our reading week. And so we went to Copenhagen, in part because my friend's boyfriend was there, but in part because we had heard it was a neat city to check out. And I just thought it was so great. I went in, I think, late September, which is a bit of an iffy time weather-wise, but it was really... I think we lucked out. There was a bit of rain, naturally, but it was really nice. And I just found it very livable. I was getting into cycling at the time, and I really like cycling around the city. And I just thought that it'd be a really great place to live. From my very quick glance at it. I haven't lived there.
You must have like seen it in school too, right? Like, it's one of those cities that's just upheld as such a great city plan.
Yeah, I must have heard about it. I think it's often talked about, right? And people are, at least in my mind, like, I don't know, I've even heard it as, you know, like the planner's dream location, which I can totally understand. It was funny, actually, recently I was listening to a presentation, and it was in, and we'll get into probably, I guess, what I do now, but it was in Istanbul, and the presenter was using precedents from different cities, and the two cities they chose were Copenhagen and Vancouver.
Oh, yeah.
Which I thought was so interesting, because I'm sitting there being like, okay, I live in Copenhagen, and Vancouver's also been a city that I've, you know, dreamed of living, and spent a couple months there. But yeah, I was like, oh, this is funny. This is completely, this presenter is completely aligned with my interests.
Yeah, yeah. So, you loved Copenhagen, you said, I want to go live there.
Yes, and I also felt that, and perhaps this is a privileged point of view, but I felt that in order to be the urban planner I wanted to be, that I needed to spend time in another city. Because also, I'm from Toronto. I, you know, worked in Toronto as a planner, but I felt, you know, maybe I should check out a different city and get a different perspective.
I'm from Manitoba. That's what brought me to Toronto.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, like that's interesting, yes.
So, like, urban planners, like, have this desire to, like, see more.
Yes.
And get, like, a broader perspective.
I agree. And I really wanted to, you know, live in a different place and get that experience. I had several cities that I was interested in living in that I thought would be kind of neat. With that, you know, several years ago dream of Copenhagen being a great place, but I never actually, I don't know. It's hard to tell whether your dream, you actually believe it could be a reality. And then I applied for jobs, and there was this one job where one of the locations you could live was Copenhagen. And And I think actually my coworkers were a bit surprised I chose Copenhagen.
Oh, yeah?
Yes, because I think there were, I mean, Amsterdam was on the list, which also would be a neat city to live in.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, I don't know, in Europe, or at least I get the sense when people are like, why did you move to Copenhagen?
Mm.
It's, you know, raining a lot, it gets dark. Like, in the wintertime, the sun sets at 3:30. In the evening, so...
It's so funny.
I got in Winnipeg.
It's definitely colder. Winnipeg gets really cold.
Yeah, that's
yeah.
Really cold. It doesn't get cold in Copenhagen.
The winters have really short days. People also are like, why are you in Winnipeg?
Yeah.
But it's funny because I was like, how did you get to live in Copenhagen? You know, I was like, oh, it's an amazing place to live.
Yes. So some people, and I think planners think that more, and some of the people that I've interacted with in Europe aren't planners. But they work in cities and stuff, but they think of, you know, Barcelona's definitely seen as a great city. But, you know, Berlin, well, and also, I would love to live in either of those cities, let's be real. Barcelona might be a bit too hot.
Mm.
I don't know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That would be very hot, I think. But besides that, and I like the seasons.
Darkness
is rough, though. It's very rough.
So you got a job in Copenhagen.
Yes, so I got a job in Copenhagen. And so my current job is that I'm a climate neutral cities advisor as part of this broader program or mission that was established by the European Union. So the European Union, the European Commission, I guess, established 5 missions, one of which is, I think, Climate Neutral and Smart Cities Mission is the official title. And there's 2 goals as part of the mission. And this is thinking to 2030. So it's a mission to 2030. For 100 cities to be climate neutral by 2030, and for these cities to become experimentation innovation hubs to, you know, provide insights for the rest of Europe to follow suit and become a climate neutral continent by 2050. So in my role, and I'm part of what they call a mission platform, which is a consortium of 33 organizations that are working to implement the mission on behalf of the European Commission. And so in my role, I advise a subset of the cities. And actually, it's 112 cities that are in the mission. So they put out a, you know, expression of interest or the call for cities to express interest. I think a lot of cities apply. I can't remember the exact number, but a lot of cities applied or expressed interest, and then they landed on 112, because there's 12 from associated countries, and then 100 from member states.
Oh, so 12 that are not part of the EU.
Yeah.
Okay. And so how many do you advise?
So the way we're organized, currently there's, I think, 13 city advisors. Some working just part-time on the mission and part-time in, like, we're in different organizations in the consortium. And I'm the lead city advisor for 11 cities and then a supporting city advisor for 11 cities. So I work with 22 cities,
mm-hmm.
essentially, but the supporting role is much more minor. I'm basically supporting another city advisor as they, you know, support the cities.
Super cool. So you're coordinating with 11 to 22 cities about how they can become climate neutral by 2030.
Yes.
Like, they're pitching you on their plan, you are coordinating with them on ideas. Is it about funding? Is it about idea sharing?
That's a good question. So cities are participating in this mission. And so to do so, they had to commit to climate neutrality by 2030. And they filled in other pieces to, you know, in their expression of interest, explaining, you know, their emissions profile, their vision, potential barriers they might encounter. And in our, like, the consortium is producing various program elements in an effort to support the cities in their journey. And cities are tasked with completing climate city contracts that outline their path to climate neutrality, so how they're going to reach it. It has 3 components. It's got a commitments piece that includes, you know, the key priorities for the city, the strategic interventions, their concrete commitments that will need to be made, and the commitments document needs to be signed by the mayor of the city, but ideally other signatories too. You know, those that are playing a key role in. So for instance, cities might have, you know, their, like in Canada, in Toronto, Toronto's mayor would sign, but also potentially they'd have the premier sign, ideally, recognizing that a lot of what Toronto needs to do to become climate neutral lies on the provincial government. But also, ideally, you'd have potentially private sector organizations also signing commitments. So that's that one piece to the Climate City contract, and then it's supplemented by an action plan and an investment plan that provides the detailed actions and the corresponding capital needs and potential capital sources to implement the actions to reach climate neutrality.
Kira, this sounds like the, like, coolest urban planning job.
Do you, that's so nice of you.
Doesn't it feel like a job that you like make up as a child to be like, this is how I want to save the world as an urban planner?
To be frank, it is kind of exactly what I would want to do.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's very challenging, which is good though, I guess. It's nice to have, it's nice to be challenged, but it's a daunting task for cities to accomplish. And I guess what we do as advisors, and we, the first city advisors who started, I think several months before me, they established a tagline for our role to, you know, be able to quickly describe what we do, because it is a bit ambiguous, and it's very much important that as an advisor, you're working with the cities, but the cities, like, you're not doing, like, it's not a consultant role. For instance, you're helping guide the cities, and you know, you help facilitate certain aspects, but you're not doing a lot of content work. And so the way they described it was that we support, connect, and advise the cities. So support them on their path, connect them with other cities, but also with experts in this consortium, and advise them on the program elements. And so the, you know, 33 organizations working on this mission are developing different aspects of support, guidance, key, you know, thematic areas, knowledge related to thematic areas to help advise the cities in their, the work they need to do.
You must have learned so much in the time that you've been doing this, just about, like, all of these different cities and the initiatives they're undertaking?
Yes. I think I feel I have. I feel there's still so much to learn. I think that's been one of the biggest challenges for me in the job is, well, first of all, I've been to Europe a couple times before I started this job. I hadn't lived there, though,
mm-hmm.
And I didn't necessarily like, I don't have deep knowledge of all the countries and all the cities within the countries, and there's, with 112 cities, there's just such a wide variety of cities. Like, we have, you know, Istanbul, which has, you know, I think an official population of 15 or 16 million, and then we have cities that have populations of 20 or 30,000 people. So the, like, range there is massive, and I think there's cities in such different contexts, and I think that's been understanding how deep to go and understanding the local context, and I think, you know, that's what we're trained as planners, to recognize that the context-specific nature in which you're working, and to have, like, to recognize and be, I don't know, almost have humility of, okay, I am coming in, I think, hopefully I'm not mistaken, but, like, you know, planners are portrayed as experts in a way, but I think we're also taught that you don't, like, you need to recognize the local context, and you need to listen to, you know, residents and other stakeholders that are involved in the work, and develop your professional opinion based on all those feedback that you receive, but to go into it recognizing that, yes, you have a professional, you know, set of knowledge that you can apply to a context, but the local context and the local interactions are very important to understand. Recognize that you won't fully understand if you're not, you know, engaged and in that local context. And so that's been, I think, challenging to understand, okay, how deep do I go? And when you're working with a city and I want to be able, I don't know, I don't want to just advise them at a surface level and say, okay, yes, we all have, you know, transportation, for instance, is a challenge that every city, I would say, has from an emissions perspective, at least to a certain extent. You know, like, cities in the Nordics and in like in Sweden and Norway, they're very advanced in their transportation, and the changes that need to be made to reduce emissions in the transportation, you know, industry or domain, but still, they have work to be done in terms of electrification or reducing road traffic or various aspects, but you can't, I don't know, how deep to get in understanding the dynamics at play is something that I continue to grapple with.
Yeah, feels like a generally like a European Union thing too, right? Just this like trying to bring all of these different countries and languages and diversity into one and like, you know, be able to spread the what's great about it and all the best ideas, but coordinating across all those jurisdictions must be difficult. Something that I think a lot of planners, whether it's coordinating between Toronto and Mississauga or Istanbul and Bergen, like I would imagine that'd be difficult.
Yeah.
For, do you have any like most inspiring initiatives or things that seem to be like really effective that people are picking up right now that maybe our listeners would be interested in?
From a climate perspective?
Yeah.
One of the things that I found interesting is how cities and how I guess municipal governments engage stakeholders. And so some cities have, like for instance, Stockholm has a electrification pact and a climate pact where they have stakeholders come together and work with the municipality on, you know, areas related to climate or areas related to electrification and thinking about how to bring, you know, different stakeholders and bring the residents of the city together to, you know, actively participate in the work that needs to be done. I think something that's a critical element, but also interesting to see how cities approach it and how they take into account, okay, what might work here. Given our experiences today.
Is there anything that these cities in Europe are doing that, you know, you're from North America, you know this continent very well, that we could learn from?
Well, I think the challenges are different to some extent. I don't know, it's tough to generalize, but I think a lot of this, I don't know how many, but several European cities at least, many probably, are, you know, retrofits is a key aspect, like building retrofits and thinking about, okay, how do we take our cultural buildings and our historic buildings and retrofit them to make them more energy efficient or to implement district heating and cooling networks. And I think the thing that perhaps could be an interesting thing to think about in the North American context without getting into specifics is, you know, that every the complexity of the climate challenge or the climate action needed, and that while perhaps we don't necessarily have the same challenge of retrofitting, you know, a UNESCO cultural heritage site, there's other elements that are very complex in, for instance, the Toronto context or perhaps other cities in North America that differ from Europe. For instance, our, I think we have much stronger dependence on the private automobile.
It maybe the inverse question is there anything in North America that is something that European cities could learn from?
Ooh.
Is the answer no?
I think
we really put European cities up in urbanism, right?
We do.
As like the pinnacle.
We do. And I think maybe what I've learned from this job is that there's such a range. Like there's cities that feel like, you know, like I would think of them as a North American city from a car context, right? Like there's lots of vehicles. People might even own two vehicles as a, you know, that's a common aspect. And then there's cities like Copenhagen where, you know, the biking is just unbelievable. And so it's interesting to try to think of a common aspect.
Right.
When, of course, there's certain countries and certain cities that are doing things. But I think it's interesting to hear, like, I have received feedback that in North America, the way in which we engage residents is, you know, something that European cities look to see and how, like, we, you know, try to be, you know, bringing people into the process and co-creating, I guess, plans and new projects, which I thought was really interesting in thinking about, you know, our experiences in the past with public engagement and, ways in which we approach that is something that they look to us to, you know, see.
Right. I think maybe what I'm hearing is less focus on Europe is like this and North America's like that, but
yeah,
that there's a huge range within each.
I think so.
And maybe like the star cities in terms of climate preparedness are more relative to each other from both places than the like cities that need a little bit more help between Europe and North America. Maybe have similar challenges too.
Yes. Yeah, I think there's a lot of similar challenges. And I think the thing is, there's no city where it's like, oh, we're set. We are going to reach climate neutrality. I think even cities that have a plan, right, like have a path for how they're going to get there, which is really, like, to know, have a concrete path, I think is just such a huge milestone.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's so many factors at play. There's so many data points that you need to fully understand the whole picture. But I think even the cities that, you know, have been working on climate since the 90s or even, you know, even earlier, but like for decades, are grappling now with their emissions that are very hard to reduce, right? They've almost achieved like what you would call the low-hanging fruit. They've, you know, addressed those emissions. I think there's no easy path, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that's really interesting. And I think how we, I don't know, I think there's a lot to learn from Toronto in terms of multiculturalism.
Mm.
When we were in planning school, perhaps this is still a thing, there was the multiculturalism class. Is that what it was called?
It was called Multicultural Cities.
Okay.
I believe now, TMU students, write in if I'm wrong about this, but I believe now it's called Diversity in Planning or something like that.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. Nice. Well, I like that shift.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And so I think that is something, you know, different cities and different countries in Europe approach immigration in different ways, but, and immigration is not, like, the also just how cities interact in terms of the different cultures.
Mm-hmm. In your work, do you have a favorite child? I mean, city? Sorry.
I can't say that.
Come on, you came on
not
the pod.
Not that I think there's a chance any city I work with would listen, but I just can't.
What do you mean,
Kira?
Well, you don't think they're listening?
Who knows? Okay, but let's say I'll broadcast it. I'll be like, hey, I was on a podcast.
Yeah.
You should listen. No, but I can't say that.
You can't pick a favorite, yeah.
But I think it's super interesting working with the cities on this and seeing,
mm-hmm.
and it's tough to, like, when it feels weird to say cities. Working with, like, people who work for cities.
Right, yeah.
City governments.
It's human beings at the end of
exactly.
the day.
Exactly. It sounds so general when you say, oh, like, oh, the cities are expressing these needs. It's like the people who work for the cities, but it's a bit of a mouthful.
Mm-hmm.
It's really interesting to see, like, there's such major barriers that cities grapple with. And this is something I feel we experience in Toronto quite a bit, and other cities probably in Canada and North America, of the power a municipality has, and also the focus that people have on local politics. And, you know, some cities have stronger powers to implement what they need to do to, you know, in various aspects, not just in climate, but in, you know, livability. Like, for instance, our saga with the road tolls.
In Toronto.
Yes, the ability for cities to be able to implement without having others come in and say, okay, no, actually, you don't get to make the decision.
Right.
And that's happening a lot in cities in Europe in different contexts. You know, in France, the cities are in metropolitan areas. But the cities, they don't necessarily have jurisdiction over transportation in their city. So in order for them to implement the actions needed to reach net zero emissions, they have to engage quite actively, and the metropolitan government needs to commit to those actions. And so there's so many things that are outside the municipality's control.
Right, yeah. I think a lesson for a planner everywhere is like understanding what level of government is responsible for
yes.
what. And I think we're always trying to find the perfect governance system. No one has it. But
yes.
It's about figuring out how it works wherever you are.
And I think that's what maybe I was trying to get at with the context-specific thing. Because when you think of how much do you know about Toronto, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the, like, intricacies that are at play. And Ontario more broadly. And perhaps other cities, too, that you work with. And then when you're trying to work with the cities in the mission, in my role, It's like, okay, I can't possibly know how much I know about Toronto because that's taken years and a master's.
Right.
And also, I lived here as a kid.
It's taken an entire life.
Yes, exactly. So I can't, you know, fully embed myself. And so then you have to really think of, okay, how can I say something that's actually useful?
It must be a lot about just like knowing who you're coordinating with on the other end and like really relying on them to understand their own process to like how to actually get this done.
Yes, and understand when to ask me things, you know, and a lot of times they'll ask the advisors aspects related to the program, right? So the Climate City contract process is quite a complex process. Both the templates that the cities need to fill out are very, they require a lot of information. And then there's a review process that goes on by the European Commission. And so there's a lot of intricacies related to that. So, you know, you often get questions about that, but it's interesting to think about when the main point of contact at the city asks you more of a strategic question or more of a technical question, and knowing how we can then mobilize. Because there's so many like experts in the consortium that most definitely know certain aspects. You know, I received a question about, for instance, like different targets related to climate neutrality or climate action. And of course, there's someone in the consortium that knows this so extensively, and you just need to know who. And I think those are, so I guess to broaden it out, because I feel like these two pieces that I've mentioned, both the like context-specific nature, but then also the knowing who to engage and when, are two aspects that are like core to a planner's role almost everything.
Understanding the system, right, is like generally,
because even though like what I'm talking about in terms of understanding cities applies to a neighborhood scale too, like you are then working, you know, in the Junction and the Beaches and, you know, Mount Dennis and all these different areas, you need to also know, okay, how deep do I need to get in understanding the dynamics at play
and the local communities and all of the different planning and the history of these places. Before this, you worked at Sidewalk Labs.
Yeah.
Also extremely exciting. Can you relate the two?
Ooh. Well, I don't think I'd be able to do this job if I hadn't worked for Sidewalk Labs, most definitely. So I started working for Sidewalk Labs when they were working on the project in Toronto, Quayside. And what I was working on was more of the like planning and design side of Quayside, and working on how the different innovations that were being proposed and designed applied to, you know, a master plan. But thinking about how the different pieces, like for instance, like the mass timber buildings that were being designed, how that fits. There was some ground floor aspects that were being worked on and programmed, and, you know, how that fits in, and the waste and all those different aspects. And then when Sidewalk Labs decided to no longer pursue the Toronto project, my role pivoted to advising mostly developers in cities, mostly in the, in the United States, who were, you know, often working on mixed use, somewhat large scale development projects, and who were seeking to advance sustainable and equitable outcomes within their project. And so we would work with them, you know, to explore what could potentially be possible in their context. And so I think when I say I don't think I could do I would be, you know, in this job had I not worked for Sidewalk Labs, I think the experience that I was able to, you know, gain in that role in terms of trying to be ambitious, I guess, or trying to like implement challenging things. Like I think like, I don't know, innovation, when you think of the definition of innovation, it's like a new concept or a new idea or a new way of doing things. Like it's not always brand new, I think. An innovation can be just shifting the way you've done things, and that can be innovative
right
away.
Yeah.
But I think in trying to think, okay, this is how it's done. We know there's are these challenges, or we're trying to, you know, enhance these pieces, like either enhance, you know, quality of life or enhance the efficiency of buildings or enhance the renewable energy potential, whatever. Thinking about how you can change management, I guess, is really what I'm trying to get at. And I think that process is really complex.
Our theme of this episode is future.
Yes.
Forward. And I think in both of these roles, you were sort of tasked with, like, creating the future that we want.
Yes.
You know? And that is change management. And
yeah.
Change management is really hard. And I think nothing important is going to be easy. So.
True. That's a really good point. It is so hard. Change management is so hard. And I think the that, like, recognizing that and grappling with that in the work at Sidewalk Labs was very useful. And I think, I learned a lot about it, just the difference of opinions and, you know, being able to collaborate. Like, I think, it's no surprise to anyone that, you know, we all know Quayside was a controversial project.
For sure.
And I think being able to effectively convey, like, and communicate with people when you have differences of opinions, I think, is a strong skill.
Yeah.
And something that I'm still working on, for sure. How to, like, you know, be able to effectively collaborate and, you know, communicate complex
mm-hmm.
ideas and why you believe in them or why you think they're good. Like, I think being able to explain the rationale in a concise, non-complex way is really important. We struggle with that a bit in urban planning. Like, I think we're drawn to buzzwords.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's terminology, like, I don't know, I have friends and family that get a kick out of me describing a development project and, like, I don't understand half the words you said.
I said something like, oh, they've got great grade-related retail. And my friends were like, what the hell does grade-related mean?
Yeah.
I'm like, I'm just describing Lululemon. Like,
jargon's out of control.
Yeah. I don't even realize that I'm doing it sometimes.
I know. And you could get really deep, like angular plane.
Yeah. I should put a dollar in the jar with my friends if I say angular plane.
Oh, that's fair. That's fair. But so I just think it's easy to, you know, lean into those words because we all know them and they have connotations, right?
Yeah.
And I think, like, even innovation, I think, is it's a buzzword, I would say. And it also, there's complex feelings around it, I think.
Mm-hmm.
In part because it's often used. It's used too much, maybe.
Yeah.
We overuse the term.
And it doesn't have a simple or a singular definition, right?
Mm-hmm.
It can mean a lot of different things.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think also in planning, it's, engagement is hard because for you as the urban planner, it's your job, it's 100% of what you're doing at work, and for the person who's there at a community meeting is like doesn't have the time to maybe listen to your hours and hours of presentation about why this is so great, right?
Mm-hmm.
But heard something on the radio that has them, you know, thinking a certain way about a project. And finding a way to both, like, hear what they're saying and maybe try to relay some of, like, helpful information that you think they could benefit from.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Are you finding that easier with, you're probably doing actually less public engagement and more, like, professional staff engagement with your job now?
Yes, completely. And I think, again, my biggest challenge is trying to figure out how much I need, like, what questions to ask and how deep to get. And you're totally right. Like, I am engaging with city people who work for the municipality, and then they are doing extensive engagement with a suite of stakeholders.
Right.
And
so we're kind of working backwards here. But before you were at Sidewalk, you were at Urban Strategies,
yes.
The firm that I'm at too, and that was your first job out of school.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like?
I feel like I learned so much. In part because we work on so many projects. I'm still using present tense. In part because I worked on so many projects. Like, there's so many projects. And they have so many different topics.
Talk about being a planning consultant.
Oh, and what it entails?
Yeah.
I think it's a really interesting consultant's, like, I don't know. I'm curious what you think about this, Neil, and reflecting on, you know, how you would describe the role of a planning consultant to your friends and how they might think of a consultant. Like, I think when people think of a consultant, they have a pretty strong vision in their mind of what a consultant entails. I think it has a lot of similarities to, and probably help prepare me for what I do now, but it helps, you are working with a client, like, through a process. So you're also, like, I don't know, you're helping guide them in a way. through a project. Well, often, if you're working, let's say, I guess it depends on the project, but if you're working with a developer who's going through the development approvals process, you are, you know, with them every step of the way, helping guide them on, you know, what is considered good planning, how to engage in the the regulatory context. And I think that's an interesting role of the planner.
I think you asked me what I think about it, and I agree with your definition. I think, like, at its simplest form, like, a planning consultant is hired to, like, give their thoughts about how to do planning better.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you're hired by a developer to help them go through the planning process for approvals of a new development, or hired by the city to go through to do a study of an area for what kind of urban change should happen there.
Mm-hmm.
You're just hired for your brain. Whether it's, like, your thoughts on how to work through the process or, like, the content of what a city should be.
Mm-hmm.
I think both of those things. And what I think is interesting as an urban planner, or at least as a registered professional planner in Canada, is, like, your first priority is, though, to the public interest.
Mm-hmm.
And you also have a responsibility to your client and to the profession. But those three things sort of guide the way that you do your practice.
Mm-hmm.
I think that advising people on how to do change is sort of what you've been doing throughout your career, though, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, as a consultant, and then not so much as a consultant, but you're still advising people on at Sidewalk about, like, innovative urbanism, and at EIT Climate Kick, but about how to become climate neutral by 2030. Like, all those are just, like, what does Kira think is best for the city?
So far. Might be like, what can Kira connect us to that could be best for the city? But it's interesting that the link you made back to change, because I would think, too, that what a planning consultant does is help facilitate change in a way that's exactly as you're saying, in the public interest.
Yeah. And that's the hardest thing about, I think, what we do, is that change is really hard for, I think, at least most people find it difficult because we're not sure what the future holds if we're changing.
Yeah.
And so that's where things can become really difficult, controversial, heated. It's amazing that people are passionate about their cities, and that's, like, the best resource that we have, I think.
Yes. I think we should be more passionate about our cities.
Yeah. How do we do that?
I don't know.
How do we get people passionate about their cities, Kira?
Ooh. I don't know, because you're so busy.
Did you ever do
jobs?
Did you do 101 day?
Yes,
did. I was in Dr. Pamela Robinson's class in civic engagement with civic tech, and one of her projects was do something real.
I did that.
Yeah.
I did. I'm sure I did that class because I would be gravitated to Pamela's class.
100%. And it was what my group did was we set up an engagement process for 101 day, which is 100 urbanism project or civic engagement projects in one day.
I'm so impressed you remember that so succinctly.
Pamela's a great teacher. How about that?
Yes.
Hope you're listening. But that is kind of, I think the goal of that is to get people more engaged in urbanism.
Yes.
But I totally agree. Like, you know, being able to sort of steal away a little bit more of people's attention towards, like, what kind of city do you want to build?
Yes.
Instead of people just really seeing, like, the, oh no, now there's construction for transit and so my commute is slower. Like, only interfacing with, like, urban change and when it inconveniences them.
But I don't know. My brother actually, he watches City Council.
Oh. You did this to him.
No, I didn't. I don't know. I have not done that regularly. So. But I think it was something he got into in the pandemic. I don't know.
It was a boring time.
Yes, exactly. And he was going through law school and then transitioning into working. And so, like, I guess he had some time on his hands. But he is, you know, actively engaged and does some things, like, you know, I think he's going to be so happy if he listens to this podcast. But he's
shout out, Kira's brother.
He set up a residence association. But how, like, recognizing, like, how can you get involved? And, right, like, he would love for people to join his residence association and things like that. But I don't know. I think it's easy to become, okay, I'm, like, one small piece of this massive system. How can I possibly influence it or engage with it? Like, I feel like there's a feeling of powerlessness.
I totally agree. Kudos to your brother. That's amazing.
I know, it's very impressive.
think that it can be kind of, though, like, once you start engaging in the process, it maybe becomes a little bit less intimidating. You
yes.
feel a little bit less powerless. My example was when I was in my undergrad at the University of Manitoba, there was a plebiscite on voting for, like, everyone getting a transit pass, immediately, like a U-Pass sort of thing.
Okay.
And I was like, yeah, we need universal transit access for students to this suburban campus. And so I got involved, and it turned out there weren't that many people involved at the start, so suddenly I was, like, leading this movement.
Oh, my goodness.
And got really into, like, going out, like, talking to students and, like, getting people engaged and trying to get this movement going, and they ended up voting, and it passed.
Nice.
And I was like, I don't know that would have happened. Like, I can see the impacts of my efforts,
mm-hmm.
and I think it totally changed my trajectory. Nothing happens unless someone actually does it.
Right.
That seems like a simple thing to say, but like behind every action is a human being who was like, I want this to happen,
yes.
and I'm gonna push for that.
And you're like, I can be that individual.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
It was addictive, and then I was like, okay, now I'm gonna be on the MPGSA, as they call it now, you know, just get involved in everything.
Yes.
It's fun if you have the time.
Yes. That's a big piece. Or, you know, I think everyone, you have time, but it's like how you use it and whether you want to prioritize.
How do you use your free time? Do you travel?
Do I travel?
Forced segues. Was that casual?
I do travel. I travel a lot for the job.
For work, yeah.
A lot recently, which is awesome. It's awesome. I have yet to master, though, the, like, you know, how to pack efficiently, how to, like, you know, whip through the airport and those kind of things.
It's
and
a skill.
It does feel a little bit like I don't know, when you're working in climate action, traveling by plane feels a little
right?
Problematic, but, you know, try to reduce that as much as possible and take the train and stuff where I can. But I have been checking out Europe, which is awesome. Definitely gone to many countries I've never been before.
What's it like as an urban planner being a traveler?
Ooh, I think it's really interesting. I think you notice things differently. I mean, you think of those buzzwords we were referring to, like, you know, at-grade retail.
Totally, I'm looking for the at-grade retail.
Yeah, definitely desire lines.
Yes.
I definitely am very critical of biking infrastructure.
Mm.
I think that's something I often reflect on. I think also, you know, the ground floors of buildings. And how, well, what's really interesting is my building, maybe this isn't interesting, but where I work, I find this fascinating. And some of my coworkers, when I was describing how fascinating it was, they didn't, you know, really engage the same way. But they were like, oh, yes, cool, this is normal here. And so but there's like, first it's in Copenhagen, it's by the water, it's in central Copenhagen. It's where the Danish Architecture Center is located. There's also a gym on the ground floor. It like, envelop, it's like surrounds a street that runs basically through the building, which is a bit interesting how it straddles both sides of the road. And then the second and third floor are like part gym and co-working spaces. And then the fourth and fifth, and maybe even more, are residential units.
Hmm.
So it's just a very mixed use building.
Yeah.
I mean, and they have a cafe on the first floor next to the Danish Architecture Center, because that seems to be a thing, and maybe that's a thing everywhere, but especially in Copenhagen, I feel like every museum or cultural institution is accompanied by a nice cafe.
Important. Very
yes,
important.
With the pastries.
Yes.
Naturally.
Okay.
I often, I don't know if you're like this, but I'm often like, could I live here?
Mm-hmm. Always when I'm traveling.
Could I live here? Maybe that's not a planner thing.
Could I live here? Yeah. I find as a traveling as a planner now different. Just, yeah, you see these different things. You look for at-grade retail. But I also appreciate things differently, too.
Mm-hmm.
I find I, like, plan for a trip in a, like, pretty specific way now.
Oh.
You know?
Do you have, like, a method?
A little bit. And if you sign up for my class, I can teach it. I'm just kidding. Trying to monetize this podcast somehow. No, so what I find I do when I'm going to a brand new city, I go on Google Maps, and I'm usually on satellite view because I like to look really like what's the reality, like a bird flying, and it's very fun on satellite view. I flip it to map view, and then look for where the beige is on the map.
Yes, I know other people that do that too. It's a good strategy.
I call it beiging. And it just shows you where, if you don't know, the beige is where the at-grade retail is. It's generally where there's a concentration of businesses, so you can be tricked sometimes if there's like a mall.
Yes.
You're like, this isn't the like fine-grained retail street I was looking for.
Like jump back between Satellite and Matthew.
It's important to use both, but I do that and like that's going to tell me, okay, so this is clearly a popular area. And then I just generally kind of try to hang out where there was like a lot of development before cars, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I find, like,
yes,
the most interesting parts of the city.
Me too.
Pre-1950, and the older the better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I also think, I mean, I don't have a design background, but I think if I was, you know, an urban planner that also had design expertise, it would be a different experience. It would be really, I don't know, I'm not as good at being like, oh, this building is fabulous facade, or things like that.
I don't know about you, but my class at TMU had people from every different background. And so there's like, oh, this person is like geography background, this person is like political science, this person's like heritage, and traveling with each of them is different.
Oh, that's interesting.
So I love to like explore neighborhoods, say, with my classmate and friend from heritage, and they'll be like, oh, yes, this is a French Romanesque revival style archway, you can see with these details. And it's just like a totally different experience.
Yeah.
What's your favorite city you've been to?
Montreal. Montreal's my favorite city, but that's also because I went to school there. And so it has a lot of, like, you know, feelings of nostalgia when I go back.
You did McGill undergrad.
Yes, I did my undergrad at McGill. And I think it's a great place to live as a student. It was just such an awesome city to live in. And it felt, I don't know, small enough that you could, you know, I don't know. I didn't really take transit when I lived in Montreal, or drove, or biked. So I walked basically everywhere. I'm super sad I didn't bike, because actually their biking is getting really good.
Yeah.
And their Big C system, like their bike share system, is amazing, especially with the hills. But anyway, but so I just don't know. I felt like it was a very manageable city. And it's a very nice city to live in. And so now when I go back, I really like it. And I feel like they do really interesting things with, you know, tactical urbanism and...
So many little pedestrianized streets in the summertime,
yes,
little plazas.
It feels very lively.
Mm-hmm.
But I went to Barcelona recently, which I've kind of always dreamed of going. I think it has a, you know, mixed feeling relationship with tourists. Which I can understand. There were so many tourists.
Yeah.
And I can understand that would be really tough if you were living in the city. But it was really, like, that's another city that was really enjoyable to explore.
Incredible. Mixed use density. Yeah.
It's such a neat concept.
What's on your list?
To go to?
Yeah.
Well, I really want to go to Berlin.
Yeah.
That's up there. I haven't been yet.
And you're mere hours away.
I know. I think I'm going to go in the fall. And London. I was in London when I was a kid, maybe 12, so I haven't been back. And every time I hear people going, they just talk about how much they love it.
Have you been to Japan?
No, I would love to go to Japan.
Tokyo is just like...
I would really like to go to Tokyo. Yeah, that's
incredible. Incredible, like, walkability, the way that they do, like, vertical mixed use as well. Like, incredible amount of, like, vertical retail density.
That's cool.
Areas of, like, a lot of action and noise and excitement, and then you go a half block off into, like, the residential area behind it, and it's, like, silent and so peaceful. And obviously incredible transit, bullet trains around the country, like, things are just done so well in Japan.
When did you go?
I was there 2019. Just before the pandemic, so I kind of had like 2 years of lockdown to really relish this trip I had just before the pandemic. I loved it.
That's awesome.
Kira, do you have any funny memories from SERP, reflecting on your time there, or any stories from the planning trenches that you want to talk about as we bring our episode towards a close?
Oh, yes. Yeah. My favorite memory from SERP is probably the field trip, which was in the Netherlands. We went as part of Studio. The opportunity for graduate students or master students to go as part of the Studio project, which looked at blue and green infrastructure to help with stormwater management. But so it was really neat. We were in a boat and we traveled through the river system in the Netherlands, all these different places.
So cool.
There were bikes on the boat, and so whenever we stopped, we get to bike around. We went on all these interesting field trips. It was such an incredible experience. I'm so glad we had the opportunity to do that.
Do you have any advice for a current SERP student who wants to become a future-oriented urban planner like you?
Future-oriented. So I did definitely contribute to an article on this, and so hopefully my advice is the same. It'd be nice to be consistent. But I think I said something about traveling a lot and really taking into account, like, seeing different cities. I think that's really important for an urban planner. Even, like, if you don't live in a different city or, you know, move a lot, and understand the challenges related to that, but to travel to get to know how different cities function and what works and what doesn't. Obviously, you can't get so deep on a visit, but you can, you know, learn a lot.
Yeah, it just gives you perspective. It's so amazing that SERP gives you the opportunity to do that.
Yes, but I think the other aspect that I really loved about Toronto Metropolitan University and why I thought it was the school I wanted to go to was the practical nature of the work and how it grounded a lot of what you learned during your courses, but also the studio projects in practical application. And I think that's really important.
Kira, thank you so much for coming on the podcast, sharing a little bit about what you do, thinking about how to prepare cities for the future, and how to prepare our planning students for future work that they're undertaking. This has been incredible.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.